It's time to replace that old dog-eared copy of John Palmer's How to Brew. Our friends at Brewers Publications recently published the fourth edition of How to Brew, and it's essentially a totally new book. The fourth edition clocks in at 600 pages, and every chapter has been updated and expanded. And there are five totally new chapters. Learn more and order a copy at brewerspublications.com. That's How to Brew at brewerspublications.com. Welcome to Basic Brewing Radio for Thursday, July 27th, 2017. I'm James Spencer. Here at Basic Brewing Radio, we're all about home brewing. This week, Zach Taggart, lab manager at 42 North Brewing, leads us through the process of setting up a homebrew lab and using it to analyze our yeast cultures. How do we know we have viable yeast and enough healthy cells to do the job? Well, Zach will help us out in that department. If you're new to home brewing and would like to get into the hobby for the first time, check out our website, basicbrewing.com, where you can find archives of our audio and video podcasts and our DVDs to walk through basic and more advanced brewing techniques. And if you buy any of our DVD combos, you get a free Basic Brewing bottle opener. And don't forget to get a copy of our Brewer's Logbook. You can use it to log and track up to 50 batches of beer. You can follow me on Twitter. My username is Basic Brewing, all one word, and we have a Basic Brewing Radio and Basic Brewing Video page on Facebook at facebook.com/basicbrewing. Thanks again to everybody clicking on the Amazon.com associate link on our basicbrewing.com site. Whenever you think of Amazon shopping, think of us first and go to basicbrewing.com, click on our Amazon ad on the right-hand side of the page. It won't cost you any extra, and you'll be helping us to bring you this show. We greatly, greatly appreciate your support there. We also have associate links for Brew Your Own magazine and the American Homebrewers Association on our site as well. You can find our Basic Brewing iPhone app on iTunes, our Android app on Amazon.com. We have a Windows Phone app. We're on the BlackBerry podcast directory. We're on the Stitcher app. We're on Google Play Music. And we're on the iHeartRadio app as well. And say if you're outside the country and you want to put a tip in our tip jar, some coinage, in our virtual guitar case, you can go to basicbrewing.com/support. Thanks to everybody who's done so already. Last night, Steve Wilkes and I got together to shoot a couple of episodes of Basic Brewing Video. We did one episode on making your own SCOBY, or a kombucha mother, from a commercial bottle of kombucha, and then dry hopping the resulting kombucha that you get. Very tasty stuff. We also shot an episode on the kettle-soured rye session beer that I soured with a kombucha SCOBY. I think both the dry-hopped kombucha and the rye sour turned out very nicely, and I'm planning to post the first of those episodes by the end of the week, so check out our podcast feed, our video podcast feed, or our YouTube channel for that. Let's take a quick look into the mailbag. Kevin from Boulder writes, I'm going to take my first stab at a sour this week, and I'm planning on using your technique of the good belly shots / kettle souring as a guide. I've got a few questions for you. Number one, you don't seem to be doing any standard boils for these beers. Is this just because you're not doing a bittering hop addition, or also because you want to keep the gravity low? In other words, do you think it's okay to do a traditional boil with this technique? If so, pre- or post-souring? Well, Kevin, you can certainly do kettle souring with standard gravity beers and a traditional boil in these very low-gravity 100% rye beers that I've been playing with. I want to use the hops in a way that doesn't extract the bitterness, just the flavor and aroma. So I'm only bringing the wort up to 180 degrees Fahrenheit, that's 82 C, for 15 minutes to pasteurize. Killing the souring microbes, you know, stopping the pH at that point, and adding the hop flavor and aroma characteristics. But you feel free to use the kettle soured wort in any way that you want. And yes, you boil or pasteurize after the souring organisms have done their duty, so that it stops that souring, level where it is, and then you ferment in the traditional way with the brewer's yeast. And he has a second question. Did you just gauge the tartness you wanted by tasting, or did you measure the pH? Well, up until my most recent batch, I didn't have a pH meter, so I was just using my sense of taste to judge the sourness of the wort as it went along, and that's not a very accurate way of doing things. I have since picked up a pH meter, and on the latest batch, I tracked the acidity of the wort over the course of 3 days, and when it reached the neighborhood of around 3.4, it actually got down to 3.2. I pasteurized the wort at that point. So it's important to really know where you are when you're doing kettle souring, because you don't want your pH to get so low that your yeast won't be able to do its job. When you sour post-fermentation, your pH can get a lot lower, and that's okay, because the yeast has already done its job. It's already done its fermentation, and it doesn't matter. Let's have a word from our sponsors, Desiree and Dave from High Gravity in Tulsa. I get an email from them saying that now through Sunday, you can purchase 2 or more beer ingredient kits or wine expert ingredient kits in any combination and save 15%. Just enter the code 15OFF2KITS, that's 15OFF, the number 2, KITS, when checking out. In-store customers, if you're in Tulsa, just mention the special when you're checking out. Offers not valid on limited release wine kits or 1 gallon kits, but that does include the new Not Everyone's India Pale Ale kit, which is a New England style IPA. And another new ingredient kit, Not Quaker Stout, which is a classic English oatmeal stout. Again, if you enter 15OFF2KITS when purchasing 2 or more beer ingredient kits or wine expert ingredient kits now through Sunday, you can save 15%. And while you're on highgravitybrew.com, be sure to use the code EBC75BB. That's EBC75BB to save $75 when buying electric brewing controllers or systems from family-owned and operated High Gravity Brew. Okay, this interview is part of a two-parter, part one of a two-parter. Zach Taggart did a great presentation at HomebrewCon in Minneapolis on setting up your own homebrew lab at home. And I was so impressed, I asked if he would come on the show to talk about it. And I wanted to split it up into two. In this first part, we talk about setting up a lab to do yeast culture analysis. Zach Taggart, welcome to Basic Brewing Radio.
Well, thank you for having me.
Well, I saw your presentation at the Homebrew Conference, and I told you at the end of that, and I've told you a couple times since then, that yours was one of the most concise and informational and useful presentations that I've ever seen at these conferences. And we've been to a bunch of them, and I've seen a bunch of the presentations. So congratulations on that, first of all.
Well, thank you very much. The cold side of brewing is something I'm super passionate about, and I just think it's the whole idea of having this microorganism that can transform compounds into something that we enjoy as a beverage is amazing. And so I wanted to kind of dig into the science of it in a way that was accessible to people, and so I hope that came across.
Yeah, I mean, it's something that one of those things that it sounds intimidating, you know, when you talk about, you know, setting up a lab in your home and getting a microscope and getting, you know, something called a hemocytometer. You're like, whoa, I don't know, buddy. But then, you know, watching you do it in your presentation through the videos and seeing the slides and all that stuff is like, well, I could do that.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, as I said in the presentation, I didn't get my degree in microbiology. This is something that I do have a bachelor of science, but it was something that I've taught myself along the way by reading books and watching videos and talking to people in the industry. And so, I really wanted to present it in a way that people could just incorporate it into their daily routine. You know, as they're setting up their mash and getting that going, they can hop over and take a look at their yeast counts from their starter and calculate a good pitch rate. It's like anything with brewing. If you do it a couple of times and work your way through the process, it becomes second nature. Just like, my first all-grain brew day, I had a huge checklist of things to go through, and it seemed really intimidating. But now I can do it in a pretty relaxing fashion. So this stuff is the same way.
A lot of people say, why do you still call your podcast Basic Brewing? you know, when you talk about such advanced topics, and I say, well, even the advanced topics get basic once you know how to do them.
Exactly. Yeah. And I hope it comes across that way to the listener. So,
well, first of all, get into your background. Talk about yourself. You know, how did you get into brewing and you know, where are you now?
Yeah. So I've been homebrewing for about 10 years now. I was a teacher previous to my current position at the brewery, and I took some time off to when my kids were born, and then the brewery opened up in my town and developed a relationship with them and kind of presented the lab idea as a way I could contribute. And, you know, a lot of breweries, startup breweries, breweries our size, feel like setting up lab procedures and quality assurance is kind of a second tier thing, but I wanted to present to them that this is something that you can set up structures for now, because you're going to need it once you start growing. And so we started work on it about a year and a half ago and have gotten a bunch of good procedures up and rolling. As a lab manager, I do a lot of work with the yeast, you know, the cell counting and viability counting that we'll talk about today. I track the fermentations, looking at how the attenuation is progressing over time, and then doing things like diacetyl testing. A lot of it is managing, you know, in a production brewery, you have a real tight timeline. You don't want your fermenters sitting open. So making sure that our yeast storage matches our brewing calendar is pretty important too. And then, you know, on the other side of it, I do the quality assurance bit, which is testing for contaminants in our packaged beer, doing sensory evaluation and that kind of thing. But in the end, you know, what it comes down to is providing my brewers with as much data as they can to make good decisions about the beers they're making.
Yeah, I know that there are a lot of small startup breweries that would think having a, you know, a guy in the lab to look at the product is a luxury.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, I think the when I talk to other small breweries about this stuff, I try to present it in a way that it's something that their, you know, brewing assistants could get trained on and get up and running. Because, you know, once you start expanding, we just bought our first, and we have a couple batches down in it, our first 45 barrel fermenter. So, you know, you start expanding pretty quickly if people like your product, and it's good to have those, you know, the cell counting skills, the plating skills down as you transition up.
And you're at 42 North in East Aurora, New York. How big of a brewery is that, and what do you guys brew?
Yeah, so we're East Aurora, New York's about 25 minutes outside of Buffalo. We are a 20-barrel brew house. Our flagship beer is a nice, juicy, citrusy IPA called Borderland. And we have a good range of, you know, we have a really nice, robust porter. And so when we got this big 45 barrel fermenter, the demand for our IPA was just kind of skyrocketing. So it was tying up a bunch of our fermenters. And so now that we have the big Bertha, as they call it, we have more room to do our seasonals and that kind of thing, but nice range of products. And, we're kind of looking at it. There's some breweries in the area that kind of jumped right into getting huge equipment and making a market presence. And we're kind of growing more organically, and we have a nice following here. And then we've just started distribution a little bit in New York City as well.
Wow. So this is off topic, but when you jump up into a much larger fermenter, does the yeast behave differently? Do you have to take care of the yeast in a different way?
It does a little bit, yeah. I mean, the first thing we had to contend with was we have a 20-barrel system and a 40-barrel fermenter, so you have to figure out, are you going to do a double brew day, or are you going to split it between days? But then when it comes to pitching, we've started off just doing the same pitch rate, you know, 1 million cells per milliliter per degree Plato. But it seems that as we jump up to this bigger size, our fermentations are taken off like a rocket. So as we go, we'll adjust to try and dial it to the attenuation curve that we'd like. But there is some adjustment there. And I think doing these counts and that kind of thing helps you fine tune those processes when you jump to a new system.
Huh. Now, as in the homebrewing world, you know, we're a lot of the times we're flying blind. as far as to our yeast health and our yeast counts and things like that. And we're kind of taking things for granted by, you know, visual perceptions more than anything else. Why should we invest in the equipment, and why should we take the time to get into something as specific as, you know, yeast culture analysis?
Well, I think it can have a big impact on the quality of your product. And I think, you know, at home you can have variations in your brew batch to batch, and that's okay. But if you come up with something that you really like and you want to be able to reproduce that, having a fine-tuned pitch rate, I think, is a big big factor. You know, we have a nice wit beer that for a while was on the sweeter side, and we've been able to dial in with our pitch rate and with our oxygen levels a little bit drier of a product and the right esters that we want in it and that kind of thing. So it can improve your consistency and the end product. I brew a lot of at home. I brew a lot of Belgian beers, and I get into the wild beers because I think that the flavors you can produce on the cold side are just so interesting that I'd like to be able to control those as much as possible.
I have an example of my most recent brew where I did a Hefeweizen, and Steve had a packet of White Labs yeast that had gone past its due date or past its sell-by date. And I said, well, you know, Hefeweizen, you know, they'd probably work with, you know, the kind of a lower cell count to develop some interesting yeast profiles. You know, I brewed a fairly low gravity Hefeweizen, 100% wheat. And I, you know, I didn't even make a starter. I just pitched the packet in there. It would have been really interesting to see at that point, you know, what my viable cell count actually was at that point.
Right. And, you know, like you said, a lot of times you're flying blind. And I think for your listeners who have stepped up to harvesting yeast and may have mason jars of yeast in their fridge, it's pretty important if it's been sitting there for a few weeks to know how much you're pitching. I know that when we harvest at the brewery, I can look at slurries that are, 600,000 cells per milliliter if it's a low flocculating lager. Or if we're using like a British strain, it can get up to, 1.4 million cells per milliliter. And that's, you're talking about a double pitch rate there. Mm. So when you look at those pitch rate calculators online, the default's usually going to be set to 1 million. But if your slurry is, half as thick as that, then your end product is going to be different than you expect.
So what do we got to, what's our investment? You know, what do we got to buy, and how much is it going to cost for us to set up our own lab at home?
All right. So if you're just looking at doing yeast counting and yeast culture analysis, you don't need a super fancy microscope. You can go with an entry-level microscope and you'll be able to see cells pretty well. So you're looking at you want a 400x microscope. The cost is kind of up to you. If you feel like later you want to get into some work with bacteria, you might want to go for a higher end with a 1000x capability. But if you're just getting into it, you could even use those $75, $90 scopes, and those will work for you. Hmm. The features that you want to look for that are helpful are an adjustable stage, because you're going to be wanting moving around to count different squares of your hemocytometer. A condenser is a real nice feature. It helps you focus the light so that you can see the cells clearly. There are some scopes out there that seem like a bargain. They offer a high magnification, but what they use is you want to avoid the 20x oculars, the eyepieces that are 20x. What that usually indicates is that their objective lens is not as nice. And so they're putting an eyepiece in there that just makes it bigger, but it won't be as clear. Mm. So for 400x, you want a 40x objective and a 10x ocular. But really, for doing, the yeast cells are going to be quite big compared to bacteria and that kind of thing. So the low-end scopes will get you started. So aside from the microscope, you also want a hemocytometer, which is a little device that was originally used for counting blood cells, but now is used in a variety of things, and that's what we work with. If you want to get into looking at the viability of your yeast cells, You can get a stain for that, and we can talk about that in a little bit. And then just some pipettes and beakers. So, you know, in all, you can get started for $100. $200 will get you a nice setup. So it really just depends on, and, you know, with some of the setups I see online, people are spending hundreds and hundreds of dollars on their hot side. So a couple $100 on your cold side is can really pay out.
Good point. Now, what exactly is a hemocytometer? It sounds like something that's really sophisticated and complicated.
Yeah, it just a little glass, a thick glass slide with a couple chambers in it. And the concept is that if you can take a little sample of your yeast slurry and put it in there and count the cells in just one little drop of it, then you can extrapolate to how much is in your big container. And what you're looking at, as far as size, the chamber is teeny. It's a 1 millimeter by 1 millimeter, and then it's 0.1 millimeters high. So just a very small sample that you put in there. It spreads it out over a grid that will help you quantify how many cells are in there. So that's, you know, the pipette is what you use to stir up your sample. You want to make sure it's nice and homogenized, because if your yeast have settled out to the bottom and you pull a sample off the top of the cloudy beer, you're not going to get a representative sample. Making sure your slurry is all mixed up nicely is going to be key to getting an accurate count. But yeah, you just pipette a little bit up, put a drop in the hemocytometer. It'll kind of suck it into the chamber, and then you can use the grid to start your counting.
Now, what are we looking for? I mean, what can we see when we put the yeast under the microscope?
Okay, so the first thing, you can just kind of make some general observations about the yeast. You'll see that they are sort of round, mostly round, some more like oblong shaped. You can get a look at the quality of the cell wall too. A nice healthy cell is going to be round with a nice dark crisp line around the outside. You'll see some cells that are have wrinkly cell walls, and that'll give some indication of the health of that cell just by observation alone. You can also see different parts of the reproduction cycle. So yeast reproduce, as a lot of people I'm sure know, through budding. And so a mother cell will make a clone of itself, and then that clone breaks away and becomes its own independent cell. In nature, they do... you know, they can create spores and that kind of thing, but because we're feeding our yeast lots of nice nutrients to eat up, they stick to just the budding cycle in brewing. And so you can actually identify different cells along that process. You can see, and with the 400x scope, you can see some of the organelles inside. You can see the nucleus, you know, merging with the daughter cell and then separating apart. Pretty fascinating stuff. And then you can also, the last thing you'll notice is the size difference. So there'll be quite a variation in the size of the cells. And the nice part is that the cells grow linearly over time. So your small cells are going to be your youngest cells. The larger cells are going to be your oldest cells. So when we're, you know, harvesting off our big fermenters, we have the cone at the bottom, and the yeast settles out kind of sorted by age. The older cells will drop to the bottom, and you can see that when you look at your first pull from the cone, it's going to be big round cells, and when you pull from the last little bit, it's going to be lots of smaller cells. So just the size alone can give you some indication of how old that culture is.
Now, when you're looking through the microscope, can you see immediately if you've got contamination?
No, that I mean, if it was real bad, I was working with a strain of Brett that doesn't have a lot of attenuation. And so it was stored in some wort that was not totally fermented. And as a result, got a little lacto contamination. And under the scope, when I put it on a slide, I could see lots of rods, but they're really, really small. And so unless you have a massive infection, you're not really going to see those. So, that's where you would get into doing plating and that kind of thing. The yeast cells, just compared to Brettanomyces alone, are twice the size.
Oh my!
So, and then when you get down to looking at you know, Lactobacillus and Pediococcus, those are going to be real, real small. And that's where you need the 1000x magnification to identify those.
Now, you talked about collecting yeast off of a conical fermenter. Not all of us have the luxury of having a cylinder conical fermenter with a collection port at the bottom. If you're a home brewer and you're brewing in a bucket or brewing in a carboy, what is the best way to collect yeast for your next, for repitching, basically?
So at home, I just do the standard, you know, I siphon off the wort into my keg, and then I have that nice yeast cake at the bottom. And so for a long time, I would just swirl that up and put it into a sanitized mason jar. And it's going to get more homogenized, which is actually good, because then you'll get a nice mix of older cells and younger cells. These days, what I do, and I think it is helpful in maintaining a healthy culture, is overbuild my starters. So if I need 700 milliliters of slurry, then I build a 1.5 liter starter, take that excess and save that. And the reason I do that is that you're putting it into a low hopped, low stress environment that's getting lots of aeration if you're doing a stir plate. So you're maintaining a really healthy culture. Whereas if you put it into a 6% IPA, there's going to be lots of hop debris. It's going to be in an alcoholic environment that will affect the yeast health in the end. So overbuilding starters is a great way to maintain a culture at home.
So I've gotten this question a few times. If you're collecting yeast either from older, overbuilding a starter or from the slurry of a previous batch, how long will it last in the fridge?
Well, the you know, the nice part about doing, being able to do viability counts with your hemocytometer is that you'll be able to get an exact answer. But in general, I find, you know, I try to use it within 2 to 4 weeks. Your viability is going to go down. I think White Lab says, you know, with their packages, after 2 weeks, it loses 5% a week. But I've, you know, revived real old slurries that I had in the back of my fridge for, you know, 6 months, 9 months. You know, at that point, most of it's going to be dead. But if you have the ability to do a starter, you can bring that back to life. You know, and if you do enjoy the science part of it and you get into plating, you can even plate that stuff out and then prop it up from individual colonies.
Yeah, we've on the video podcast, we've on our Zombie Belgian show, we took the dregs of a Belgian beer that, and I can't remember how old it was, but it was pretty old. And by doing very small starters, you know, essentially, and stepping it up, we were able to propagate enough yeast for a, you know, fairly high gravity 5 gallon batch of beer, you know, off of that one, you know, one bottle dreg, you know, from that previous batch. So.
Oh yeah, yeah, absolutely. And you know, if you, as long as you go easy on the yeast and do small steps, and you know, are doing low gravity worts, you can really coax that back into a healthy culture.
Now, if you're keeping, say, some slurry from a previous batch of beer, like in a mason jar in the fridge, is there the chance that the longer you keep it in there, the yeast viability is going to go down? But is there also the chance that more contamination, if there's some contamination of the wort, that could propagate more, or is the refrigerator going to help suppress that?
The fridge will help suppress it for sure. The, you know, having unhopped wort, that's the one downside. If you're overbuilding your starters, you're not going to have hops in there to help guard against it. But I think if you keep it under beer, the pH and the presence of alcohol will help ward that off. But, you know, you're right in that the longer you keep it, the longer you risk the chance of something else growing in there. You know, I think... I tried for a while doing the yeast rinsing, but I felt like that wasn't, you know, it was another vector of infection that you could put into it. And so I moved away from that. And the other thing you need to think about is if you're putting water on top, you know, having the alcohol on top, the wort on top, is osmotic pressure on your yeasts, and water is the same. So some people do isotonic solutions of water to kind of balance the pressure inside and outside of the cell. long term, but I find just having some beer on top is a nice protectant in the end.
And the more you play with it, the more chance that you're going to mess it up.
Right, exactly. I think that's why, you know, why people have moved away from secondaries and that kind of thing as well.
Now we've got our sample, and we want to take a look at it. Now, how do we use this fancy gear that you've got us set up with?
Okay, so the first thing you're going to want to do is dilute your sample. If you took, if you had your slurry in the fridge in a mason jar and you decanted the beer and took a sample of your slurry, it would put so many cells on your in your viewfinder that you wouldn't be able to count them. So what you want to do is dilute those a bit. I find that when I'm using a decanted slurry, I do a 1-to-100 dilution. So you just take 1 milliliter of your slurry and put it into 99 milliliters of water and then stir it up to really homogenize it. If you're looking at something off of like a starter, and so it's going to have a lot more beer on top of it, then you could do like a 1-to-10 dilution. You can really do any type of dilution you want as long as you keep track of that number, because you'll use that in your formula to do your end count. But you dilute your sample, so it's so you can do an accurate count on your in your microscope. You then just take one little drop of that. You're going to fill up your pipette after you swirl it around, and to kind of basically all you have to do is just touch it to the edge of the slide, and it's the capillary action is going to suck that drop under the into the chamber. And I fill up, there's two chambers on a hemocytometer. I fill up both and do an average just to make sure I'm getting a representative sample. And then, you know, in that process too, you can also put in your viability stain as well, which we can talk about after. But essentially you're just taking a sample, diluting it, putting it in your hemocytometer. And then once you get it under the microscope, you're going to see a bunch of grids. And what you want to do is count five of those grids. You're going to count the four corners and then one in the center, and then just multiply that out. You could count every single one, but if your sample is nice and representative of your slurry, counting five is plenty to do.
And you're actually looking through the microscope, and you're looking at that grid, and you're looking at the little squares, and you're just counting. Do you have like a little clicker or something that you use to keep track?
Yeah, exactly. You can do it without, but having a little there's little like golf clickers. It can make it so that it's a lot quicker and you're more accurate. The really important part is to be systematic about it. You want to, you know, looking through a microscope can be kind of taxing on your eyes. So you want to make sure you have a system. I start in the upper left-hand corner and sweep across in the rows as I go down. As long as you're consistent in the way you do it each time, it's not really a big deal of exactly where you count. But yeah, you do a count of the squares, add up all five, and then punch that into your calculation. And you're going to see daughter cells and mother cells on there. The general rule with that is if the bud attached to the mother cell is at least 50% of the size of the mother cell, then you can count that as a separate one. But, you know, I think all that stuff, there's tons of videos online, and I have my video from my presentation that I'll send you a link to so that your listeners can watch that. But I think in the end, whether you hit all the points of the lab procedures is not as important as the way you do it. You know, if you can do your count consistently each time and you get a good product on the other end of your process, if you get a nice beer from it, then you'll be able to repeat that as long as you keep your same system each time.
Now, at this point in the counting process, do you look for the wrinkly ones? Do you look for the dead ones, or do you count those, or, you know, how does that work?
So if you want to get into, so that's just going to give you an overall picture of the density of your slurry, how many cells are in there total. If you are looking at a slurry that's been in the fridge for a bit, then some of those cells are going to be dead, and you don't want to include that when you're doing your pitch rate. So that's where the stains come in. There's two main stains that are used in viability counting. That's methylene blue and tripan blue. And methylene blue is what most breweries use. It's super cheap, readily available. You can, you know, get some off Amazon for a couple bucks. It's used in aquariums to keep fungal growth at bay. But it's, you know, easy to use and available. Tri-Pan Blue is more of a lab grade standard. So the way it works is methylene blue is an is broken down by enzymes that are contained in the yeast. So once the dye comes in contact with the yeast cell, if they are alive and producing this enzyme, the dye will break down and the yeast cell will appear white. If the yeast cell is stressed or dead, the enzyme is going to be less present, and so the yeast will turn blue under there. Tri-Pan Blue is called an exclusion dye. And so what that does is that just tells you the integrity of your cell wall. So whether the cell is active and fermenting or, you know, in a storage phase, if that cell wall is intact, it will remain white. If the cell wall has some wrinkling or degradation in it, then it will be exposed to that dye and appear blue. In both cases, the dead cells appear blue and the live cells appear white. And so what you're doing is you can do this at the same time that you do your cell counting. When you do your first dilution, you know, 1 to 100, let's say, then you take 1 milliliter of that, put it in a little test tube or in, you know, some little container, take a milliliter of your dye and put it in there. And then when you do your count, you'll do a full count of your density. But then you can also do a calculation of what percent of your slurry is alive and what percent is dead. And so, you know, at work, I use the Tri-Pan Blue. I find it's really good for, we don't have a propagation system for our yeast. We, you know, harvest off the tanks, put them in storage, and then repitch that way. So for us, having Tri-Pan works really well because it works with lower viability slurries. It's good down to about 70% viable. You can get a real accurate count. Whereas methylene blue, they say, it's really not accurate below like 90%. So if you're at home and you're just doing counts off your starters are going to be generally pretty healthy. And so methylene blue will work just fine for that. If you are taking stuff out of storage and it might be less healthy, you might want to try the Tri-Pan Blue. And, you know, Tri-Pan's a little bit more expensive. It's like $40 for a bottle rather than $4 for a bottle. But that'll last you quite a long time. So, you know, you have some options there.
So you can buy all this stuff. Where can you find this stuff? I assume Amazon.
Yep. Amazon has a bunch of it. Some of the lab supplies are, you know, they'll go through the third party on Amazon, but you can also go to Weber Scientific. Before I did the presentation, I contacted them just to make sure homebrewers could access all their stuff. They have you know, beakers, they have microscopes, they have pre-made plates if you wanted to get into plating. But they are a good source for scientific material, and some of the science websites, the science labs require you to have like a business address. But Weber Scientific is good to go as far as ordering as an individual. But you can get most of this stuff on Amazon as well.
And there's an associate link on basicbrewing.com if you go through Amazon. But anyway,
yeah, you know, I was going to say, I always thought, I've listened to your podcast for a long time. I always thought the first time I'd be on was as some embarrassing Amazon featured product of the week.
Well, you know, we can't tell who bought what, so no worries there. There is some stuff that I don't talk about that comes through. So
I'm glad I avoided that front.
there's some grown up stuff that won't make it on the end of the show. so we've got our numbers. We've got you know, the cell density number, and we've got our cell viability number. What do we do with this? How do we make it work for us?
Okay, so you're going to get, you know, let's say you get a nice even 1 million cells per milliliter, or 1 billion cells per milliliter. What you can do then is just do a percentage of that. So let's say you have 1 billion cells per milliliter and 80% viable. When you go to your pitch rate calculator, you can just multiply those out and get 0.8 billion cells per milliliter. And it's as easy as that. you know, a lot of this stuff is, it's difficult to picture just over the audio, but if you go online, there's tons of videos available for cell counting and doing this kind of stuff. And that's the way I first learned. And then I worked with some people in the industry and they gave me tips as well. But, you know, this will just give you a nice outline. But if it's something that seems interesting to you, go in and looking at those videos, they'll take you through step by step on the process. But once you get that number, all it is just putting it into that the calculator online and you're good to go.
And you can, in using this, in the real world, you have come across examples where, you know, using this actually makes a difference in the final product of your homebrew?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You know, I mentioned the wit example at the brewery, but, you know, at home, I have played around a bunch with, I love saisons, and so I want to be able to get, you know, a lot of them will give you different characters at different pitch rates, at different temperatures, at different levels of oxygen. So I've found, I like to use the Blaugis strain of saison yeast, and I found I get a really nice character if I kind of over pitch a little and under aerate. And so that's where these numbers come in really handy. You can get different flavor profiles, but then you also get different attenuation rates. You know, at the brewery, we've been able to, by adjusting our oxygen levels and our pitch rates, we've been able to cut 2 days off our fermentation cycle.
Wow.
So, you know, I know there's a lot of the experiments on Brewlosophy, which I love the stuff they do. And, you know, you might not be able to the general population might not be able to pick that out blind. But I feel like in my work, you know, when you're trying to make a consistent product and you're looking at, you know, what your product is like and you know the variations in it, you can sense that difference. And then the other way that it comes in is at the brewery, at least we you're kind of on the small scale breweries, the big guys have inline detectors for oxygen levels when you're aerating your wort or oxygenating your wort. But smaller breweries are kind of flying blind with that. And so we use flow rates and that kind of thing. But I was getting, you know, unsatisfactory viabilities from our harvests for a while. And we realized that what we needed to do was adjust our oxygen levels. And after we played with that a bit, our viabilities went up. You know, so if you're trying to maintain a house culture over time, you can start to see is it getting worn out? Do I need to adjust my process a little bit to keep that a healthy culture?
Yeah, that was going to be my next question is if you're repitching and repitching and repitching, it seems like to me this is necessary in, you know, kind of making sure that your yeast is still doing what it's supposed to be doing.
Yeah, you know, back before I started doing this stuff, I remember I was a big fan of the Y yeast 1968. It's a British strain. I'd use that for a lot of my pale ales, IPAs, and, you know, pushed it through many, many generations, but then it just started to go off. And at that point, I just have my, you know, my sensory take on it to tell if it's off. But if you have your scope and you can do your counts, you can, and even if you get into the plating part of it, you'll know exactly how healthy your culture is and if it's performing the way you want it to, and how it's responding to things like storage. So it can be a pretty good part of your process. And, you know, as we mentioned earlier, doesn't really cost that much in the scope of things.
Scope of things.
There you go.
In the macroscope of things.
Well, there you go.
Well, you mentioned plating, and the second half of your presentation was on, you know, plating cultures and collecting cultures and examining, you know, samples of things. And I didn't want to cram it all in this conversation. Because, you know, I like to take the time and, you know, and ask questions and actually have a chat about things. So I've invited you back again to talk about that and give us a brief preview of the things that you'll be talking about next time.
Yeah. So then, you know, the next step up from this is using petri dishes to streak out cultures. So if you have a house culture, you can take a little sample of it and streak it out on a petri dish and actually grow up individual colonies. You can look for contaminants, like you mentioned earlier. You know, what I love to do is there's tons of different types of media, and there's some that will kill off the brewer's yeast. There are some that will kill off bacteria. So there's a type of plate that I like to use that will help me just isolate Brettanomyces. And so what I can do with the plates is I can, whenever I can find a interesting bottle of, you know, wild beer, I can then capture that, isolate and capture that strain of Brettanomyces and then put it into my collection. And you know, this, alongside that, you can get into the yeast banking, that kind of thing. So now in my basement, I have, you know, in my chest freezer, a dozen or so strains of Saccharomyces and Brettanomyces, and it gets me really fun. You know, I think I probably have more down there than I use on a regular basis, but it's just a fascinating part of the science of brewing, that you can break it down to the individual colony of yeast and then grow that back up to a pitchable amount in just a few steps.
Wow. Well, all that for next time. And it'll be, you know, we haven't scheduled when that's going to be, but one thing I want to do is give the listeners an opportunity to ask questions about that and also ask questions about our conversation today. And we can, you know, if you're available, we can, you know, you can, I'll send those emails to you and you can answer them directly, but then we can talk about them on the next time you're on the show as well.
Yeah, that sounds great. And, you know, I'll send you a link of my presentation video for cell counting so that your listeners can check that out. You know, there's a bunch of blogs out there. Sui Generi, I think it's called, he's a microbiologist in profession, and he did a bunch of videos on cell counting and plating and that kind of thing. So people can check those out to help kind of put all this stuff together. And then, yeah, come back with some questions and we'd be happy to answer them.
Awesome. And I'll put any link that you have, I'll put it in the description of this episode on basicbrewingradio.com. But Zach, this has been a lot of fun. You make it sound easy. And I think that's removing the intimidation is, you know, all a part of it. And I appreciate your time, and I'm greatly looking forward to next time.
Yeah, you know, that's kind of my goal, is to talk about this stuff to make it seem accessible to people. It's definitely not hard, and I think it's just the funnest part. At the brewery, I kind of say that the brewers are all busy making the wort, and me and the yeast get to make the beer. So I think the cold side is just great. So I hope that's come across, and we've given some people some tools to play with it a bit more.
Awesome. Thanks, Zach.
All right. Thank you so much, James.
Thanks again to Zach. I'll put a link to his video in the description of this episode on basicbrewingradio.com. Or you can search for 42 North Brewing. That's 42 North Brewing on YouTube. And look for the video on their channel. If you have questions for Zach on this episode or the next episode, send them to me and I will share them with him, and I'm sure he'll answer you through the email. And then we can also talk about your questions and the answers when we get together again next time. And right now we're set to talk again on August 14th. So send in your questions before then. If you have brewing questions, show suggestions, or just want to say howdy, write to James at basicbrewing.com or just fill out the contact form on basicbrewing.com. And please don't forget to tell us where you're from. Check out our support link, where you can throw a couple of bucks into the tip jar by subscribing financially to our podcasts. Be sure to check out our DVDs, Extract Brewing and Partial Mashing, Stepping into All Grain, Low-Tech Lagering and Decoction Mashing, and Introduction to Wine Kits. You can find them all on our site. Get a free Basic Brewing bottle opener with any DVD combo, and you can check out our Basic Brewing shirts in the store as well. You can find our logbooks, where you can track and log up to 50 batches of beer. Check all those out at basicbrewingshop.com. Thanks to everybody who's continued to click on our Amazon.com link. We appreciate the support there. Our featured products this week that were purchased through the link are King of the Hill Season 13. That's King of the Hill Season 13, Bobby. And Winsome Wood Nightstand / Accent Table with Drawer and Cabinet for Storage. Thanks again, everybody. And remember, I can't tell who bought what, so no worries there. Just click on the Amazon.com logo on our site the next time you feel like Amazon shopping. We greatly appreciate your support. And don't forget, you can also join the American Homebrewers Association or subscribe to Brew Your Own Magazine through the associate links on basicbrewing.com. That's all until next time. Until then, thanks for listening, everybody. I'm James Spencer. Production help for Basic Brewing Radio and our website is provided by Kelly Dodson. Basic Brewing Radio is a production of Active Voicing. We'll talk to you next time, everybody. So long.